This is New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm Banafsh Madaninejad. My guest, Carlotta Gall, was a lead reporter on the New York Times team that won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting from Afghanistan and Pakistan in 2009. Her new book, the culmination of 12 years of reporting in the field, is called The Wrong Enemy, America and Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. In the book, she claims that the Pakistani government, the so-called biggest regional ally of the West in the war against terror, was in fact misleading the West in aiding, controlling, and using jihadi groups like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda for its own purposes. She suggests that the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence service, may have known that Osama bin Laden was hiding in the country and had provided protection to him and his family. Carlotta Gall, welcome to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies.
Thank you for having me.
I'm wondering if we could begin, if you could begin by saying a few words about yourself. I'm just really curious, how did you get interested specifically in Afghanistan and Pakistan? And as you're in Tunisia right now, so I might even say Middle Eastern politics in general.
I think it started in a combination of ways. I was actually a student of Russia, and I read Russian at university and French, and I went to the Soviet Union as a student in the 80s, and it was just when Russia had invaded Afghanistan, and that was one of the big topics of the time. And amazingly, I ran into some soldiers as a student in a bar who'd just come back from Afghanistan, and they told some hair-raising stories. And it was, of course, still the Soviet Union, and that was so it was a fascinating insight. At the same time that I was there, my own father, who's a British journalist, television journalist, was actually in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen. And he was gone for several months. In those days, there were no sat phones. We didn't hear from him. And I knew he was in the mountains there trying to get the story of what was going on, because it was very much a closed war. It was hidden. Access was very difficult. And so I was intrigued, you can imagine, as a student, to see both sides. And from then on, I was fascinated. It became, you know, Afghanistan became Russia's Vietnam, if you like. They had terrible casualties. They did terrible atrocities. It was just a quagmire that drew them in for 10 years. And then they had to fight to sort of get rid of and get out of. And I really do believe, having studied Russia, it then helped precipitate the end of communism. It was such an important event in the late Soviet history. And then to see it from the other side, through my father and then later myself, to see all these refugees, it was the biggest refugee problem of the time. You know, a third of the population left. It's the same number of Syrian refugees now, 3 million left Afghanistan. No, sorry, 5 million left Afghanistan. That was a third of the population fled the country. So it was a huge issue. Afghans started arriving in England. They came to our home. And then later I went to Pakistan and saw many of the refugees, and then later got to go into Afghanistan. And so I was fascinated. But also the Afghan people and the Pakistanis who hosted them were so engaging. And that immediately drew me in. They're hospitable, noble, generous people, and then they were getting caught up in the most horrific events, which then changed the history of the world. And so, you know, I then later became a journalist, and who could not be drawn to this country? And so, of course, when I knew it quite well by the time of 9/11, you know, I put my hand up to my editors and said, hey, I know this place. I've been there. I know all of the players. They didn't realize at first quite my connection, but when I did go there, I just knew so much already that I actually, you know, came to the reporting very easily and did quite well, and then they asked me to stay, and I stayed and stayed because I was so intrigued by the country, the people, and you know, this incredible long war that's eaten up that country and that area. And then to see America get involved in a similar long projected war as Russia had been in, you know, I was hooked.
You know, I was in Iran. In fact, I was in Abadan, the city where the Iran-Iraq war started. And I was a kid. I was just 9 years old. And I've always been fascinated about the effects, the long-term effects that war has on a population. And I mean, I didn't really, the war, the Iran-Iraq war that I experienced, maybe the first month was pretty intense, but after that we went to Tehran and it was pretty low-key for the most part. I can't imagine being an Afghan in Kabul, for instance, and having lived through the 1980s and the 1990s and the 2000s. And since you've been on the ground, or you were on the ground for as long as you were living with the Afghans, how would you describe the long-term effects? I mean, I understand I'm asking a very general question, but and I'm sure that it's different from person to person or sort of class to class. And could you say something?
But it's the whole it's the whole nation, and that's what's so incredible. And it's so many generations now, because they all get married quite young, they have children, and so you've already got the third generation, as it were, that's been constantly at war, that's lost people. And so, you know, some of the kids that come and work with us, either as interns or trainee journalists, we've had a bureau now with the New York Times since 2001, and so we've trained up a lot of young journalists, translators who've gone on, and when you hear their stories, sometimes they're very young and they don't know so much, but when they start to delve into their own history, sometimes they start to go back and interview their grandparents, and it's just unbelievable the layers that are revealed. And that their fathers come out with, and so you'll have generations where, you know, the grandparents disappeared under the communists, and then the father was tortured under the Russians or disappeared in, you know, as a mujahid, lost, and then you have the next generation of often then women suffering under the Taliban, trapped in their homes or teaching secretly. And then now you've got this generation of the 10 years that I was there suffering, you know, threats from the Taliban, trying to get educated, trying to get jobs, having to flee their home. So it's just unbelievable to see the generations have lived through this and how they all protect each other or advise each other. It's just heartbreaking. But, of course, what it does is it's really created a very, very nervous nation, I think. They all live for the short term. They're very clever, in fact. They've learned how to survive. They sit on the fence. They avoid politics in many ways. They manage to make friends and networks on both sides of every conflict to protect their families. So it's fascinating to actually see how a nation survives through it all from experience, and it's heartbreaking.
I wonder if it's even apt to talk about something like ethics in a situation like this.
I think it is, because I think there are some over the years who have behaved, despite the horrors, have behaved so honorably and correctly and tried to raise their families, and so you meet every day people like that, and it's so impressive, and they're so brave that so you never fail to be impressed. Every interview you do, you know, you see some terrible horrors, and there's, you know, we all know that there's some very unattractive things about Afghan society. You know, there's the situation of women and children and so on is appalling, and then what the outsiders have all done to the country, but you meet almost every day someone who just impresses you by their simplicity or their honorability, and so and their dignity in poverty or in difficult circumstances. So ethics definitely remains there. And what of course is impressive about Afghanistan is it's a deeply religious country, and people actually live by their beliefs, which is really impressive to see.
It becomes pretty clear from the very first few pages of the book that reporting in this region, the Afghanistan-Pakistan region, was at times a serious threat to your life. I also read you wrote something in the New York Times yourself that you recently lost a close female journalist friend and found out that another one was seriously injured in Afghanistan. This is while I think you were touring in the West for your book. What is it like being a reporter, more specifically a female reporter, in such a dangerous, hostile environment? I mean, this is war. You're a war reporter, I realize that. But I guess when I think of day in, day out, there's almost for us normal folks, it's really hard to imagine how losing friends, and you talk about that in your book, to losing friends and coworkers year after year, day after day, sort of being on the ground. What does it take for someone to be able to sort of push through that, not become a ball of anxiety, depression, sort of? How do you maintain your calm, your sort of center, your power? How do you stay grounded? Yeah. How do you keep working?
Well, I think that's the key, actually. You keep working. I think I've been lucky in that I learned early on, and it was actually when I was reporting in Russia, in Chechnya, when I first started doing war reporting, full on, that I could actually do it, that I was not easily panicked, that I could keep pretty centered to the job, that I could, you know, the main thing about war reporting is you've got to get the story, find out what's going on, and get back and file it, write it and send it to your office. And I managed to do that, and I found I could actually operate in foreign countries, in foreign strange places, more or less efficiently. And so then, of course, what happens is you know, everyone talks about journalistic objectivity, but actually you get terribly involved because you see the injustice, you see the horrors, and you want to report it. And it doesn't mean you take sides, but you desperately want people to know what's happening and to get the truth out. And, you know, all journalists learn that one of the first casualties of war is the truth, is objective facts. And so it became terribly important in every conflict I've been in to relay what's happening so that other people know, so that politicians can make well-informed decisions, the public can decide, you know, for themselves what should be happening. And so that's your driving force. And that's, you know, along with a lot of adrenaline, because it is dangerous and you're always in a rush because you're trying to work and get the story and get it back. And there's always, you know, lots of obstacles. So you actually just remain focused on that. And that, of course, helps you manage the horror that you're watching because you've got a job to do. And without a job, you would be standing there crying. But actually, because you've got a job to do, you go and do it. I think in the long term, it really wears you down. And so you have to, you know, recognize that and take time off or find ways to alleviate that. But I think really, because you believe so much in the job, and I think every foreign correspondent and every war reporter really does, that's why you do it, and that's why you keep going back. And of course, you want it to help the people who you're witnessing and get their story out. And as I say in the book, certainly I wanted to be a voice for the Afghans because I was well aware that they are a pretty beleaguered, poor nation that not many people do listen to. And certainly the Afghan civilians in the conflict and the villagers out in very remote areas weren't being heard. So I really wanted to record their experience and their voice.
Did you get a chance to come across or have conversations with American soldiers or NATO soldiers? Were you ever at all interested, or did you think that was sort of taking away from what your focus would be? Were you ever interested in telling their stories and sort of bringing them into the picture?
Yes, and I think, I mean, one of the things about the war is it became so dangerous because of the Al-Qaeda element, the Taliban, Taliban's hostility to foreign journalists. It was very difficult to report in whole areas of Afghanistan after a certain time freely in the countryside. So in anywhere south of Kabul after the first 5 years, you could only travel with the military, the American military, or with NATO. And then you would have to go on an embed, you would be attached to an army unit, and you could live with the troops. And so, of course, you lived and ate and slept with them, and that meant you were in very close proximity and you saw their side of the war. I didn't perhaps put a great deal of that into the book because I felt I wanted to tell a story that I thought was being ignored and not heard. And I think the military have, you know, their ways of getting their story out. And of course, we've seen a lot of very good accounts by former soldiers and generals as well of the war. So my feeling was to write what was less known, especially the Afghan point of view, but also, you know, this whole undercover current that goes through the book, which is the Pakistani element in the whole story. And I wanted to uncover that and show that, and that really hasn't... I think a lot of people have alluded to it, a lot of people have mentioned it, but I really wanted to unpeel that. So that was what the task of the book was. I don't mean to ignore the American experience, because, of course, that's going to fill generations of books and research papers, because it was, in the end, the longest American war to date. And so I think that, you know, that's very relevant. So I show a couple of cases, you know, a couple of stories here and there of things I came across, but I regret there's perhaps not more, but, you know, there's a limit of space. So perhaps that's for a later book.
Yes. I can't wait. Getting into the meat of the book, I guess the first question that comes to mind is, how did you first start suspecting that Pakistan was, in fact, at least to some extent, protecting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda? So what were the first clues for you?
I think I knew a lot of the history already. So I knew the story of the rise of the Taliban in the 90s because I'd been interested. I'd been to Afghanistan before. So I knew the level of involvement. And actually from the beginning, I remember trying to unpick some of the things that I witnessed, the flights that evacuated a lot of the Pakistanis at right at the time of the first, you know, the first months of the American operation. A lot of Pakistanis got caught in the north of Afghanistan, and then we were hearing they were being evacuated by secret flights. I came across a lot of Pakistani prisoners and interviewed some of them up there in the north. And so already that was intriguing and tantalizing because you couldn't quite get enough. You couldn't quite put your finger on it. Then there were Pakistanis who ended up in Guantanamo. We couldn't interview those. But you tried to unpick those sort of stories. But it really, I think, came to gel when I went to Quetta in Pakistan in 2003. And that was because I started hearing the Taliban were there. You could see them. You could interview them, perhaps. They were milling around in the bazaars more and more frequently. So I traveled there with a local translator and reporter. And, of course, with some Afghans who helped me find them. And they said, yeah, we'll take you along. So they take me to this, you know, main intersection in Quetta, and they're nervous. They know they've got to hide me a bit because I'm a foreign journalist. And so I'm in the back of a minivan with curtains around, a bit like a woman who goes in purdah. But then they brought these Taliban figures over to me who sort of chatted through the window. And it was fascinating because the Taliban were all milling there, and it looked just like Afghanistan under the Taliban when they were all freely moving around in their big black turbans, and you know they have a certain attitude and a certain style of clothing, and it just looked the same as they always were, and that was that was fascinating to see them. And then, in fact, they were quickly told to stop talking to me, and we were told to move on, which again was an indication of there are people in charge here. They're sort of politically controlling this group. So then I became more and more intrigued. So I followed up and managed to get more interviews in houses. And I started to piece together what they were up to. And it was fascinating because they were sort of in hiding, but they were starting an insurgency. And then I followed it from there. And I was one of the lucky ones who remained in Afghanistan throughout. So I could track over the years the steady growth of the movement, the resurgence of the Taliban. And, you know, piecemeal daily stories were perhaps not very significant because the war in Iraq by then was starting and that's where the world attention was. But when I, you know, accumulated all that over the years, I realized this was undeniable and terribly important because it was so damaging, the build-up of this resurgence and the support they got from Pakistan. And it became to be a terribly dangerous movement again. And so I plotted all that, and then I absolutely felt I had to put it all in a book.
You paint a very accessible picture of the relationship between the Taliban and, I guess, the Talibani figures in the early years before 9/11. And I really appreciated that because I hadn't really come across that. I'm no Afghanistan-Pakistan expert, but, you know, sort of just being in the field, I just never seen that before. And I liked the description, the sort of power play between the North and the South that you set up. Between the United Front in the north with Ahmad Shah Massoud and the Mullah Omar in the Pashtun south. Can you elaborate on that a little bit and sort of talk about how that tension started and how it sort of ended, if you could?
Yeah, I mean, because it continues today.
Does continue today, okay.
Yeah, I think so. And in that, you know, luckily we've got now a united government in Kabul. But it threatens to divide the country. And Afghanistan is an amazing country in that people, they're not separatists, but the divisions became aggravated under the Taliban. And it's, I think, terribly damaging for the country. And so that's partly why I felt so alarmed by what I was seeing, that the Taliban was resurging and the divisions were being aggravated, and it was being aggravated by the neighboring country. In fact, the two neighboring countries, Iran also did its damage in the 90s, but actually was, I think, much more constructive in these years, ironically, when America was there. But Pakistan aggravated the thing. So what happened was you had in the 90s a civil war. You had terrible... after the Russian invasion and after the departure of the Soviet army, you had all these militias groups that had been fighting, the Mujahideen, who'd been fighting the Russians and successfully saw them off. But they then, of course, with very little help from the outside world, turned in on each other. And that was aggravated, I think, by the neighboring countries who all wanted to support their particular group. And you see the danger of that now. You, after a conflict like that, on that level, you have to have a great deal of international help to control things and support. So what happened was that the Taliban grew up out of that chaos. At first, they were supported by many people because they seemed to be God-fearing, straight, not corrupt, honorable types. But very quickly, it turned into a southern group that was trying to dominate the country. And Pakistan aided and abetted them and encouraged them to conquer the rest of the country. And instead of making what we would call a unity government, they encouraged them to just conquer the north. And of course, the northern groups, which had become powerful in their own right during the war and had their own fighting groups, fought back and resisted. But there were some terrible massacres. There were terrible atrocities. You know, as the thing went to and fro. And many people in the north really suffered from that. That was a terrible time. There was, you know, incredible hunger at one point. There was a famine. People were dying all over the place. The Taliban would sweep through and send people fleeing to the mountains and killing and burning. And they laid waste to fields and vineyards. It was really, really a horrific time. And then sometimes they would be pushed back. So that really aggravated the Pashtun South between the divide between the Pashtun South and the northern groups, which were, they're also Sunni, but there are some Shia groups. But also they were just ethnic divisions. They were ethnic Tajiks, Uzbeks, Turkmens. So Farsi-speaking as opposed to Pashtun. Now, Afghanistan has always had those divisions, but it had never really become so damaging as during the Taliban time. And that legacy remains. And so it was easy, I think, for the Pakistanis to whip up that Pashtun solidarity after the American invasion and use it to try and say, you know, this government is illegitimate, they're American puppets. And so they used many of the southerners, the southern Pashtuns, and made them join the Taliban, encouraged them to, saying that they were disadvantaged. And, you know, it was an irony because Karzai was a southern Pashtun president, and yet the Taliban managed to use, you know, turn people against him and build up an insurgency against him, partly because of the American presence. It was easy to say these are infidels, you know, they've come here to occupy the country. But partly also because Karzai had made this deal with the northerners to try and unify the country. And so they could use that saying the northerners have been our enemies and so on. So that was heartbreaking to see, completely unnecessary, I think damaging for the whole region, for Pakistan as well. But that was the message used. And so it did great damage, I think, to Afghanistan. And you're going to have those scars, I think, for a long time because, you know, Pashtun southerners died in the north, and many northerners now in the army are dying in the south. So, very sad, and I think unnecessary to have brought it to this stage. I don't know if that answers your question, but
it does, which leads me to another question. And I thought a really important point that you covered in the book. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you in answering that last question talked about how Pakistan sort of supported the Pashtuns in creating this chaos. Can you talk a little bit about why, the reasons you thought this was happening? Why was Pakistan wanting an unstable Afghanistan?
I think where Pakistan is coming from first is to protect itself. It's a paranoically insecure young nation. You know, it only got independence 60 years ago. And it's always been concerned about its far greater rival and perceived enemy to the south, India. And so Pakistan is paranoid about being encircled. And so Afghanistan, which is on its western border, it's always felt the need to dominate so it can have a sort of soft and what it calls it, it has a term for it. It calls it strategic depth. But what it means is it's a sort of either a client state or a buffer state that is guarding its back and preventing it from being encircled by India. So its obsession has been to patrol the strategic depth of India. So Pakistan's obsession has been to control Afghanistan in its own strategic interests, it thinks, to have this buffer state or to have this strategic depth of security on its, you know, western flank. And that made it look for proxy forces among the Afghans that could be controlled and supportive of Pakistan. And so it naturally looked to the Pashtuns who live along the border that is the Durand line, which creates the boundary between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And they have that Pakistan has its own Pashtuns on its own side. So it was obvious to co-opt the Pashtuns along the tribes along the border to be friendly. And so when it saw the Taliban rise up, Pakistan very quickly latched on to this force to co-opt them. And I think they just overreached themselves. They thought these guys are great. They can be friendly to us. They're the right people to run the country. And of course, they weren't the right people because they were very fundamentalist and backward in their outlook. That suited Pakistan, I think, because they thought they could control them better. But of course, it meant that they weren't acceptable to the world, but also they weren't acceptable to many Afghans, especially in the north and in the center. So the whole policy backfired, but that was Pakistan's driving aim. Now, other people will say, as you mentioned, that they wanted to keep Afghanistan unstable. I think there's a bit of that, but it was more so that they could dominate them. They wanted to keep them in their place, under their thumb, more so they could dominate what is their poorer, less educated neighbor, after all, and less populous. You know, Pakistan is a much, much bigger country in terms of population. So it was more of a colonial attitude to their poorer, smaller neighbor. That they wanted to dominate. And I think they don't want them to get powerful, and they didn't like them to have powerful friends in the form of NATO and America for the same reason, because this was Pakistan's backyard and they wanted to control it. And that's why Pakistan objected so strongly to America's presence and the whole presence of NATO forces in the country next door.
What do you think the effect of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda presence has meant for, I guess, Pakistani culture and Pakistani politics within Pakistan?
It's been incredibly damaging. And I think for anyone like me who's been visiting Pakistan for over 20 years, it's very, very sad because what we've seen, and I mean, no one wants to dictate to a country how they should be, but what we've seen is this steady radical Islamization of Pakistani society, which, you know, after all, after the British Raj, you know, was very educated, very forward-looking, very open country, and it's become steadily more and more closed and more extreme. And, you know, anyone who knows Pakistan, it's an incredibly hospitable culture and an incredibly relaxed form of Islam. It's a mostly Muslim country, but they have Christians, they had some Hindus, they're less and less nowadays. They even have Parsis, you know, who come originally from Iran. But the tolerance of that sort of South Asian, very relaxed attitude towards self and person's religion has become less and less tolerant and more and more extreme in its Islamist thinking. And that's been incredibly sad to see because, of course, what's happened is the culture has been warped and the state adopted this attitude of supporting jihad and supporting the training and indoctrination of jihadi fighters, including many from foreign countries who passed through Pakistani madrasas. And that has just created this unbelievable movement, which is spreading across the whole region and spreading, you know, into the Middle East or, you know, coming back and forth from the Middle East, because, of course, some of it came from the Middle East. But now Pakistan is actually an exporter of this as well. We know a lot of Pakistani fighters or fighters trained in Pakistan have now gone to Syria to join ISIS. Al-Qaeda, you know, in the end made its headquarters in Pakistan, and Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of Al-Qaeda, is still in Pakistan and I believe protected by people there. So, and he is still, you know, expounding this very damaging and very dangerous worldview, and continuing to train people and send them to war in different countries, which I think no country really should host and should be part of, because it comes back to haunt you. And that's what's happened in Pakistan. It's brought war and terrorism right into their cities, right into their homes. And I think probably the hardest thing for me has been to interview families whose sons have been, now we're hearing about it all over the world, but when I was doing it in Pakistan, it was less well known, but they were, you know, people's sons who were, they thought were in madrasas getting a nice religious education to turn into probably mullahs and teachers, were going off and fighting and then turning out to be suicide bombers and never coming home. And the parents were absolutely amazed. They had no idea the type of radical teaching their children were getting. And they often didn't know where their boys were. And they, you know, the first thing they would know is someone was telling them, your son's Shaheed, you know, martyred in Afghanistan. And these were Pakistani parents who didn't even know where their sons had been for the last few months. So that was appalling to learn and to see the suffering and the fear of these families who just couldn't control this radical Islam that had invaded their communities. And that was one of the most shocking times of the reporting in Pakistan, and it's still going on today.
So I'm just wondering, of the decision makers in Pakistan, the ISI sort of decision makers or the generals or even the religious establishment, I guess in the beginning and now, what percentage, I mean, I don't need you to give me numbers, maybe you could sort of describe, what percentage actually supported this interpretation of Islam, the Talibani interpretation? I mean, was it completely a political move on their part, or was there something more?
Yeah, I think it'd be hard to say a percentage, but I think what was clear, there was a level of state decision making in it. Right from the time of the war against the Russians, the ISI believed that this was the important way to go, to train Mujahideen to fight what was then the Soviet threat. After the Soviets left, the Pakistani ISI continued that policy and decided to keep training and keep using proxy forces for their own foreign policy. And so they sent them to Kashmir to fight, to try and wrest part of Kashmir for Pakistani control. They continued to send them into Afghanistan to dominate that theater of war.
So they just figured soldiers, ideological soldiers made good soldiers.
And they were what the Americans call force multipliers. When you have your standing army, which is there and costs a certain amount, and then you have many, many reservists, if you will, who are these mujahideen, these men who know how to do an insurgent type of war, a different type of war, but are very good shock troops, extra troops, force multipliers, the Americans would call them, in case of any war, but also to spread, it was clear it was part of a policy to spread Sunni radical Islamic power in the neighboring regions. And so we learned, you know, I actually met one of the trainers who had worked on the Pakistani military payroll for 15 years, training fighters from not just Afghanistan and Kashmir, but also Pakistanis, but also Chechens, Central Asians, Bosnians. And he traveled to those places on the Pakistani military payroll. So there was, I think, you know, there was a policy led by some in the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence, and the Pakistani army, to spread the idea of radical Islam further afield, but also just to train up hordes and hordes of young men so that one day they could be used in a theater that was useful. And I think we're seeing the results now. Even then, in the 90s, I met Chinese Uyghurs, they're Muslims from the Western China, I met them on a bus, and they'd all been trained. They'd been studying in madrasas, then they'd got a military training in jihadi camps in Pakistan. They'd done a quick stint in Afghanistan to experience the real war. And then they were on their way home to visit their families back in Xinjiang province, which is the far western Muslim area of China.
And this is as early as 1990, you say, right? In your
this
book.
Was, I think it was 90, it was 91 or 92 that I met these guys. Mm-hmm. You know, 15 years later, we're seeing the results of that. We're seeing more and more radical attacks in Xinjiang by young men who've been radicalized to an extreme level. And I'm not going to support China in its policies against the people of Xinjiang, but this sort of radicalism, I recognize it, and I know where it's coming from, and it's come from Pakistani training camps. So it's, you know, the repercussions of this end up then with ISIS in Syria, which, you know, we're all flabbergasted by, but any of us reporters who've been watching this have seen it coming for years. So Pakistan has a lot to answer for on that level. And, of course, Al-Qaeda, because, you know, they've also been doing it.
So it's really interesting because I remember when you were talking about the Uyghurs, you also said that they gave them Pakistani passports, and they were all proudly showing you the Pakistani passports, which I guess so having the backup force to fight for Pakistan, I suppose they could always contact those Uyghurs and say, come join us, come fight for us, and they would come. I guess what I'm missing is why would Pakistan, I sort of see maintaining a force within Pakistan that could be manipulated to fighting in Kashmir or India, but I'm missing some information as far as why the dissemination of the ideology would be happening as far east as maybe China or the Chechen region or.
Yeah, I think there are some more extreme than others. So when you read, if you read the book, The Bear Trap, which is a fascinating sort of self-revelatory account by a Pakistani major general, I think, as to how they fought the war against the Russians, so and how they trained the Mujahideen, and this was the time when obviously the American CIA was in coordinating with the Pakistani ISI to train the Mujahideen to fight the Russians. But you also saw in that book the desire of the Pakistanis to go one step further and to push into the Central Asian states of what was then the Soviet Union. And their feeling was then, you're fighting a war, so you push into where it hurts your enemy. And so that was their aim. But what was fascinating when, after the Russians left and the Soviet army withdrew from Afghanistan, Pakistan didn't stop. They kept doing things. And we few reporters who, and I used to go to Central Asia quite a bit because I was based in Moscow in the 1990s. We were aware that the preachers were coming in and the radicalization of the very, you know, very simple Muslims from Central Asia in those countries who they'd been living under communism. They really didn't know what was coming. And a lot of them fell for it. A lot of them were very impressed with these foreign preachers. And that was a calculated aim of the Pakistanis and of course, Al-Qaeda, and also the various Muslim preaching parties. So it was all of them jumping onto that. And I think that comes from this general trend in which you've seen in Pakistan, and I think it's driven a lot by the Gulf Arab states, especially Saudi Arabia in those days, to create a Sunni bulwark against Shia Islam. And that's where you really see the support that comes into Pakistan, which is enormous from Saudi Arabia and the various Gulf Arab states. And they give all the money for all these madrasas and the spreading of Wahhabism. And it's a sort of an obsession. I think it's a result of having too much money, but also an obsession to counter the theocratic state that was in Iran. And you know, you could say it comes from paranoia or it comes from aggressive hegemonic desire. Whatever it is, that's what's fed this spread of radical Wahhabism.
So in the book, you talk about how the U.S. military commits cultural blunders during the period that you were there. And could you tell us some examples of those? I enjoyed reading those because I always wondered it was very difficult for me to imagine culturally untrained soldiers sort of amongst everyday Afghans. I always wondered what the result would be. So I enjoyed reading those parts. Could you give us some examples of those?
Well, I don't know. My first reaction is, all the awfully sad things that happen. You know, the horror of some of these elders who have got arrested early in the early stages, and
I guess I should. So I'm dividing this question into two.
Okay.
I'm sort of talking about the issue that you bring up of proportionality, and also at the same time cultural blunders. Yeah, I mean, address those together separately, whichever way you think is best.
I'm trying to think of what cultural blunders that
you for instance you talked about. Sort of the female space, the sort of interior, and the and how soldiers would not a lot of goodwill was generated by being insensitive to the space that females sort of were supposed to have to themselves. And
yeah, I mean, I think I don't know what training the Americans were given very early on, but it was very you learn it very quickly when you go to Afghanistan, but people guard their women very strictly, especially in the rural conservative areas. The women always stay inside. They're always veiled in front of especially strange men. As a woman, of course, you're very lucky because you can go in, you get invited inside the house, and then you see, you know, the women's quarters, and then there's always a guest room or a separate space where the men will receive outsiders or male guests who aren't allowed into the inner sanctum. And, I mean, we've all read about, you know, in historical times of harems and protected societies, and Afghanistan's really like that. And also, a man's house is his castle, and that's an English expression. We know what that means, but really in Afghanistan, it's really serious. You never go into somebody's house uninvited, so you knock at the door. And if you go with Afghans, and of course I always traveled with a driver, a translator, a local reporter, photographer often, and you would see the Afghans would always, you know, cough or knock at the door and wait. They would never go into someone's house until the male or sometimes it was a child comes to the gate and then opens up. And of course, Americans, you know, they were soldiers. They were taught to raid places, but they never understood. I never saw them really understanding that to take care of the sensibilities. And I think, you know, they felt we're here to look for terrorists, so we can't be waiting on people because they'll run out the back door. But for the Afghans, of course, it really incensed them. And the anger built over the years and got more and more. And you could see that in President Karzai. He just used to get so emotional by the end and so angry that he was repeating, you know, 7, 8, 9 years later, the same thing. Don't raid people's houses. Don't go into, there should have been a better way of working with local forces to find the bad guys, but not rile the entire community. And it took a very long time for the Americans to get that right. I'm not saying that everyone was tone deaf to the culture, because there were some clever people and there were some some very impressive special forces often who understood things, who quickly learned to work with local forces. But by and large, there were some really terrible mistakes made. And I'm sure I made mistakes too. But, you know, when you're an invading army, you're just asking to turn, you know, you turn the whole population against you with some of those very straightforward cultural mess-ups. So that was, you know, sometimes funny, but usually infuriating to see. And then, of course, you saw it actually being very, very damaging. People warned us, especially elders who'd been, I remember meeting elders who'd been imprisoned and humiliated by American searches. Afghans are very sensitive about nakedness, for example, and being demeaned in front of others, especially, for example, they would have a father and son and hold them together, and that was always very painful for younger men to see their father humiliated or stripped naked in front of them. So that, I think, sometimes was probably done on purpose to put pressure on an during interrogation, but it caused terrible damage to the support of the people. That I saw, I was learning that early on, and I was hearing that in interviews in the very first years and months. And that, again, was mystifying that there wasn't a quicker change in the attitude of the
people. So you think that the same results would have been gotten if these sensitivities had come about? You don't think it would have impeded the U.S. military's ability to actually do what they were supposed to do?
I think they should have learned quicker and they should have changed quicker. And I think what made it very clear to me was when General Petraeus came and Stanley McChrystal came with their counterinsurgency. Some people call it a strategy or a plan. They got it. They understood how you defeat an insurgency, which is not with an invading army, foreign army, and not overwhelming force, which had been the policy before, or with counterterrorism raids. It's actually by using a whole what they call a holistic approach of everything. You use force, you use fighting, you use intelligence, but you also use the community and you use above all local forces. And so, you know, Petraeus absolutely mobilized, like he did in Iraq, a massive increase of the Afghan army and security forces and police. And then he also engaged a lot of the local villagers and mobilized them in self-protection forces, or as they were called, they were actually called local police in the end, and they came, you know, under official arm of the Interior Ministry. But then when you get everybody with a stake in the play, that it changes the whole thing. And so that it's that what changed things. But that came in 2009, but actually only enforced in 2010, so 9 years after the original American intervention. So, and they even knew it because the very first few months of the intervention was using, you know, Afghan forces on the ground. And they should have built on that. And instead, yeah, they went into a completely different type of conflict, which was, which was incredibly damaging and backfired significantly. So I think they did learn and they did change their ways, but way, way too late when the Taliban was already a much, much bigger force. Had free movement in virtually half the country. So then, of course, it became a huge fight on a par with, you know, the fight in Iraq. And that was also made you mad because they should have understood it earlier and changed earlier. And, of course, the problem was that they were so busy in Iraq that the best minds and forces and attention was all there, rather than in Afghanistan.
Right.
So the person of Hamid Karzai keeps coming up. And one of the things that I enjoyed about your book was how cutting it was, how candid it was in its criticism of Pakistan, but at the same time, how compassionate it was with, you know, certain American military figures, most certainly with the Afghan population. But what was really interesting to me was your description of Hamid Karzai. And, you know, I'm sure you know this, folks in the Middle East, as soon as you sort of have the CIA going out into the field and finding somebody and bringing them and sort of installing them, that's even what it's called, right? Installing them in that position. I mean, I know he was elected and all that, but you immediately sort of look at that person with suspicion and call them a puppet, a U.S. puppet. So it was really interesting to me how you described Karzai. Could you talk a little bit about him and what you found, what sort of person you found him to be?
Yeah, because he is actually a fascinating guy, and I think, you know, got quite maligned in the end, because when the war went bad, it was very easy to criticize him and lay the blame on him a lot. But I found, he's by no means perfect, but he's quite likable and engaging. He's also infuriating. But I think I started to understand where he was coming from, you know, because in the early days especially, I saw him a lot and interviewed him a lot. And I think he was right on, he's an excellent politician. You learn that very quickly. And he really understands his people, which is what I liked and I recognized very quickly. You know, even though he was living in that palace under American guards and, you know, really unable to travel around a lot, he did have his pulse on the Afghan, on the pulse of the people. And so when he talked about the civilian casualties, the mistakes the Americans were making, that was sincere and he was correct. And he was always, I think, pressured to stop criticizing, you know, the American actions and to show support. And that cost him a lot politically. And then I started to see he started to realize that. And he started to get really angry, because however much he talked about the main issues, which were go to the source of the problem, you know, it's in Pakistan, stop killing Afghans, stop abusing Afghans, you're turning the people against you.
So he knew from the beginning. He knew from the beginning the source was Pakistan.
Yeah. And he said it from the beginning. And that sometimes he was told, look, stop talking about it. We'll deal with Pakistan. You just, you know. And you know, General Musharraf on the other side in Pakistan was very clever at complaining. This is not constructive, this sort of thing. Karzai, you know, he would literally tell the Americans to tell Karzai to shut up. And they did often. And so eventually Karzai got fed up. And it got so bad that by the end he didn't trust the Americans were on his side. And of course,
so do you think the Americans didn't really know what was going on? Didn't know which one of the sides to trust?
I think they knew. I try and show that for a long time they didn't really focus on the problem, but they'd been told by Karzai and his cabinet and so on and his officials for many years. I think they only really started to put the spotlight on Musharraf and his ISI and to see what they were up to only by 2006, 2007. So that was partly the Bush administration's failure to really look closely at what, of course, was an ally and a major non-NATO ally in the war on terror. So that was a failing. But I think people, for example, in the CIA, they knew. But they had a different calculation. Their point was, above all, we need Pakistan's cooperation on the nuclear issue, because Pakistan is a nuclear power. And above all, we want cooperation on finding the top top al-Qaeda people. And so they didn't really mind that the Taliban were restive in southern Afghanistan. And I think that was a major miscalculation on the side of the Pakistan, of the the American intelligence and military, because we could see on the ground, this is going to grow. And of course it did. And it then came to actually threaten the entire American mission in Afghanistan. So I think some of them saw it, but I think the politicians didn't pay enough attention. And then, of course, Obama comes in, and he uses it as an election issue, that the real war is in Afghanistan and the Pakistan. He goes to town on Pakistan is the place where we must target it, and Al-Qaeda is there, and so on. And then, of course, he gets into power and actually doesn't go the whole way. He just concentrates on pulling out. And, okay, he gets bin Laden, which obviously was a huge coup, but he doesn't get the rest of it. And he's now pulling out the troops with really the problem unsolved and Afghanistan not able to fight it on its own. And so it's really, it's a decade and more of American failure to understand the depth of the seriousness of the problem and really getting to grips. And that's because the political will ebbed. You know, at the beginning, obviously, after 9/11, there was huge political will to go into Afghanistan. But when the war went wrong and it got too long, the desire was to get out and just leave it. And it's unfinished. And that's a real tragedy for the Afghans, because you go in, you know, you mess everything up. You persuade a lot of people to put their lives on the line to work with you and to try and fight it. And then you pull out before it's over. You know, it's a real repeat of Vietnam, really. You know, you're leaving a lot of people in the lurch. And so that's what made Karzai so angry. He felt betrayed by the end. You know, he also, of course, you know, faked the election and then got furious when it was exposed. But he felt also very undermined in that by the Americans, because he felt they were trying to replace him and being underhand about it. So that personal slight, I think, made him really, really bitter and angry. And a Pashtun, an Afghan, you know, will never forget the slight. So that really, really was damaging. But in the end, I think he was really hurt. He could not accept that the civilian cost that the Afghans bore and the failure of the Americans actually to go to the heart of the problem, which was in Pakistan. And, in Pakistan's state policy, it wasn't just that they had an uncontrollable problem in their tribal areas. It was because the state was pursuing that policy. And that hurt him bitterly, because in the end he realized that for the Americans, the Afghans were less important than the Pakistanis or the Pakistani relationship. And that, I think, he really didn't forgive. And so I tried to show that, because in the end, towards the end of his time, I think a lot of the reporting on Karzai was, oh, he's off on his rock, you know, ranting again, and he's saying extravagant things. And I had to show what was in the man behind. And he's certainly not perfect, but I think he had right on his side a lot of the time.
In the book, there's a part where you say, I'm quoting, "The American bombing of Afghanistan in 2001 had meanwhile lit a fuse in Pakistan's border regions, and they erupted in a volatile mix of militancy, religious fervor, and tribal solidarity." And then a little later you say, quote, "They were angered at the intervention." So reading this, I immediately, so it just made me think of the intervention that's taking place in Syria and Iraq today. And, you know, the charge that responding to violence with more violence can only create even more extremism. What would you say to such an assessment?
It's really, really difficult. And I've covered a lot of wars, and I've actually seen both happen, because, yes, I definitely saw I think it's very difficult, because definitely the bombing of Afghanistan after 9/11, which, as you know, most of the world believed, you know, America had had a terrible affront and was allowed to seek redress, angered many, many Pakistanis and Afghans. Of course, a lot of Afghans were relieved the Taliban was being targeted, and they were actually thrilled when they saw how accurate some of the bombing was. But there's no doubt about it, civilians suffered. In Pakistan, I think they were so used to the solidarity of the Mujahideen against the Russians that it just was like a continuation of that. And I think a lot of them were not well educated. A lot of the religious parties whipped it up. It was spontaneous, but it was then used. So when you see that, you see how people are used, what is the solution? You mustn't play into the hands of the radicals and allow that. So of course, bombing any country, you're gonna upset people, and you're going to turn a lot of the people against you. But always at the back of my mind is also the war in Kosovo, which I also covered for the New York Times. I lived in Serbia. I was actually I was the Balkans reporter, but I lived in Belgrade. And so when the war in Kosovo happened, part of that war, I was in Belgrade under NATO bombing. And I would have to go with the sort of Serbian information ministry trip to go and see the bombing and the results of the bombing. And they would always point out the civilian casualties and so on. But what was fascinating was actually in a soft, but a very definitely a dictatorship by Milosevic, was you saw a mixture. You saw a rallying against the people who are bombing us and the people, the solidarity behind Milosevic, even though a lot of people didn't like him. They kind of rallied around during the bombing. But it also made them particularly angry against Milosevic. And so when I had a very good Serbian reporter who could, when we went on these government trips, I would sort of go with the minder and see the damage. And my Serbian reporter would slope off and talk to people. And he would find them, you know, a bit away from the crowd, he would find them cursing and swearing Milosevic. And sure enough, a year after that war, the people did rise up and overthrow the dictator. And so my point is that you might see an immediate rallying of support against the bombardment, but it also it can undermine the dictator or the regime that you're fighting against, because people get angry that we've been brought to this. It's a very fine balance, and I think you have to think very hard before you intervene in any place, because every war I've seen has been appalling. Civilians always suffer, however brilliant your weapons are and however targeted you say your strikes are. And so I think we need to be there as reporters to show the cost, the high cost, to show people you can't do, you know, surgical strikes. There's no such thing. But at the same time, I do see that there are some regimes that are so, so harmful to their own people that they, some way we have to find in the world to stop them or to alleviate. And so I'm one of the people who says the drone strikes in Pakistan have been remarkably effective. And I think Pakistan has been able to whip up the anger against those if they are well done. And if, as we've seen more lately, they've been more careful about, more specific about their targeting and more careful about only doing them away from civilian areas and so on, they do have a place and they can be effective. So I think I've always found it a difficult line, but I have seen that the drone strikes in Pakistan's tribal areas, contrary to a lot of the press reports that they're killing civilians, that they're whipping up anger, I found that actually when you manage to reach the tribes people in the area, a lot of people support them, because especially latterly they have managed to be more specific, to only target the particular car after it's left a civilian area. And so they've been remarkably accurate and effective. And in a place where Pakistanis weren't going to do ground operations, the Americans absolutely politically could not felt they could not invade Pakistan. I think there is a place for some, you know, strikes like those drone strikes. And I think they have been effective in disrupting Al-Qaeda and the camps and so on. But I think we have to be terribly careful, because I've really never seen any bombing campaign that hasn't hurt civilians. So I think however brilliant your weaponry is, you're always going to hurt people. And so you have to be terribly cautious, I think, about airstrikes. But at the same time, I do feel, you know, if they'd moved earlier, you know, early intervention is another thing that I would say it often can save lives. And my feeling is earlier movement against the Taliban, or earlier dealing with the Taliban before they had this resurgence, was, of course, the much, much more sane and sensible course. To leave it so late so that it becomes such an enormous problem, you could argue the same with Syria, is as damaging, you know, and appeasement perhaps of this very dangerous radical Islamic jihadism has been incredibly dangerous, because it's spread and more and allowing someone like Pakistan with its Saudi backers to you know engage in 20 years of this is now what we're reaping the rewards of. And so being blind to that and not acting on that has been incredibly damaging for the whole world now, we see.
Your book came out in April of 2014, and I'm just wondering what the Pakistani response has been to the revelations that you make.
Actually, better than, I don't know what I was expecting. It's the Pakistani reaction was amazing, actually, when it first came out, and as in India as well. Huge reaction, because, you know, it serialized in the New York Times Magazine, especially the Pakistani elements. So it was on every talk show that week. Of course, mostly criticism, but it was talked about. So it was out there. And then, of course, there's a newspaper there that has a partnership agreement with the New York Times. So they were supposed to run the magazine piece in a big front page weekend edition, and they lost their nerve. Those editors were under extreme pressure, so they instead they couldn't change it or insert something else, so they just ran a huge blank white piece of white space on the front page. So that was, you know, that was again talked about, and that was, you know, a sign that this was dynamite, that the editors were too scared really to have a very critical piece on the ISI. Then it dropped away. Perhaps it was still talked about in places, but then there was another resurgence, and I saw columnists start to talk about it, and people started to review it. And then it was pictured on the front page of the Sunday magazine of Dawn newspaper some months later, along with another book, a colleague, Abu Siddiq's, on the Pashtuns. And that was also great to see, because just to have the cover out there. And the other great thing about Pakistan is, although I can't go there anymore, I know I don't even apply for a visa, but I won't get a visa. And I know they're extremely angry with me, and probably there might be people who'd want to do me harm. At the same time, the book is in the bookshops. So, you know, Pakistan...
Really?
Yeah, the media don't dare touch certain topics, and the talk shows that did talk about it often denigrated it. You know, they talked about it, but they poo-pooed a lot of the especially the anti-Pakistan stuff. But it's also, you know, not a total censorship. And so in the bookshops, it's been there. So by and large, yeah, not too bad. No Pakistani publisher has asked to publish it, though. That's a long way off. So, the good and the bad. But I really felt I had to write it for future generations, if not for immediate. People need to know. And I have had, you know, a nice reaction from Pakistani journalists who dare to say so. So I think it was worthwhile. And I think down the road, you know, people will study it, which is good.
What about the U.S. reaction to the book?
That was also, you know, quite gratifying because it made quite a fuss with the main, you know, claim that the Pakistanis knew that bin Laden was hiding in Abbottabad in a house and that the ISI had actually placed him there and had a man in charge. That was a new claim and, of course, caused quite a stir. And I think what is quite gratifying is that, you know, after the original sort of fuss and the, you know, I did a couple of weeks going around and talking, since I think I got a lot of reviews, but since I think you can see that people have actually read the whole book because that was just the Pakistani element. And now in the months since, I realize, you know, that a lot of the other arguments which were left out in that first book tour, you know, the issues we've talked about of the proportionality of the American fight, the failure to understand the problem for so many years, even the handling of Karzai, that I think that's sinking in because I see it referred to in places. I see people coming back to those issues. So that's gratifying because, you know, all an author wants to do is open a debate or put some ideas out there. And then, of course, the other thing that is close to my heart is to examine the situation of journalists in Pakistan, which is partly why I start with getting beaten up and how to try and point out how difficult it is to report on these issues for Pakistani journalists. And that has got a lot of notice as well. So that's really important because that's, you know, a very, very tough issue for working journalists in Pakistan, and we need to keep battering away on that.
Carlotta Gall, we've taken so much of your time. Thank you for giving it to us. And is there something that we left out that you'd like to add before we have to say goodbye?
I think you've covered pretty well everything, haven't you? I mean, I think just that that last point about the Pakistani journalists, I really believe if they hadn't been intimidated and controlled in the way they are, and it took me a long time to quite understand how much the ISI manipulates and controls the media and individual journalists. And I think if that hadn't been the case, you know, they're well capable of finding bin Laden and finding Mullah Omar, who's still there, you know, and Zawahiri, who I always hoped to find myself. But I think, you know, the Pakistani journalists are well capable of it, but they're intimidated, they're threatened, some of them have been killed trying to work, and a lot of them have had to leave the country. And I think that I'm glad that in my introduction I exposed that and showed quite how bad it is, because they don't deserve that. And, you know, I think the policy is redundant of supporting and hiding Al-Qaeda, and the Pakistani journalists shouldn't suffer for that. So that, actually, I'm very proud that I managed to get that in. Often as a reporter, you don't reveal how we work and the dangers we go on. But I'm now glad that I did that, because I think it's a very important issue that needed a hand.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
And all that you do.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for talking.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.